This podcast is sponsored by IQBar. Your favorite clean, functional, delicious nutrition brand is raising the bar with a little help from Thomas Keller, Michelin star chef of the French Laundry. IQBar and Thomas Keller have teamed up to create a salted caramel chip protein bar and yuzu mango hydration mix. With toasted macadamia nuts, rich caramel flavor, and brain-boosting nutrients, this bar is like having a Michelin star meal in your pocket. Pair it with the taste bud tingling yuzu mango IQ mix hydration mix, packed with magnesium and adaptogens to improve clarity and mood. With Keller's culinary excellence and IQ Bar's commitment to great taste and clean ingredients, this limited edition collaboration is simply mwah. And the best part is that 10% of sales go directly to Chef Keller's nonprofit, Mentor, that supports aspiring young chefs. Great taste, great nutrition, great mission. Go to IQBar.com today and enter promo code KELLER20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products plus free shipping. That's IQBAR.com, promo code KELLER20. This podcast is sponsored by IQ Bar. Your favorite clean, functional, delicious nutrition brand is raising the bar with a little help from Thomas Keller, Michelin star chef of the French Laundry. IQ Bar and Thomas Keller have teamed up to create a salted caramel chip protein bar and yuzu mango hydration mix. With toasted macadamia nuts, rich caramel flavor, and brain-boosting nutrients, this bar is like having a Michelin star meal in your pocket. Pair it with the taste bud tingling yuzu mango IQ mix hydration mix, packed with magnesium and adaptogens to improve clarity and mood. With Keller's culinary excellence and IQ Bar's commitment to great taste and clean ingredients, this limited edition collaboration is simply mwah. And the best part is that 10% of sales go directly to Chef Keller's nonprofit, Mentor, that supports aspiring young chefs. Great taste, great nutrition, great mission. Go to IQBar.com today and enter promo code KELLER20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products plus free shipping. That's IQBAR.com, promo code KELLER20.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
We are diving deeper into the Karen Reed case today. Not just the what's, the when, or the where. We're going deep into the why. Why do certain people stick to narratives that seem to defy evidence? Why do others double down on a narrative even when it starts falling apart? And more importantly, how do you spot the difference between a truth teller and someone selling you a polished, high-gloss version of events? Joining us is someone who spent his career doing exactly that, retired FBI Special Agent Robin Drake, former head of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program. Robin, let's start here from your perspective. When you see a suspect publicly doubling down in their interviews, aggressively pushing a counter-narrative while seemingly disregarding contradictory evidence or contradictory things that she said in the past that are directly different than what it was now, what are the behavioral tells you're looking for that might point to deception versus conviction?
There's a lot to unpack in that.
Yeah, there is.
We can go deception versus truth if you want first, and that is because that's the toughest one. No one can predict deception from truth. And so, especially when you have, as been so noted so many times by us and others, when you have so much alcohol involved, and then as you have time passing, you have false narratives and false memories implanted in your brain, and then kind of morphing it into the topic of what we're talking about is why would she do the things she's doing? And a lot of it is, from my standpoint and our conjecture, is she's trying to continually control the narrative that's been placed against her. She feels like a victim, and she's trying to control the situation. And that's what starts it. But then when you get the fan club around you that is supporting you, believing in you, and standing by your side, that is continually echoing the same thoughts that you have, you feel extremely justified. And righteous in all the things you're saying. So even if it contradicts things you might say before, you're going to be able to rationalize that away, because as you're consuming information, it validates your own self-opinion. You put out more opinion about yourself, it's validated again. It becomes this never-ending loop and cycle of doing exactly the same thing.
I mean, it feels, and I pointed this out earlier in the day, it feels a lot like, I mean, and I can't diagnose her, you can't diagnose her, but it feels very much like narcissistic behavior or borderline type behavior. This constant need for attention, this constant need for affirmation of one's own stories, and this constant need to be right, to not be able to take in information that may be contradictory towards her own beliefs about herself. So she just seemingly, and the spookiest part is changing narratives, changing facts about what happened that night. It's not just, oh, I feel different about it now, or time has passed. It's literally different stories, especially right. when we're talking about the night that John O'Keefe died. Initially, she came in with, I might have hit him, I might have clipped him. The interview with Dennis Murphy on Dateline, she talks about all of that. And she also says the line in the middle of all that, he didn't look mortally wounded, which I found to be very interesting, because she's going from theoretically, could I have hit him? Could I have clipped him? He didn't look mortally wounded, but could I have done this? Could I? It was an interesting mix in there. These are all speculation, then factual statement of observation, and then more speculation. It felt kind of like a Freudian slip in that. I mean, is that what that was? Because it was completely out of context to say he didn't look mortally wounded. Why would anyone say that unless you're actually recalling a moment of your memory?
I think you're exactly right. And I also think every behavior we're seeing her do is as we keep saying on case over and over, is that it's fitting a pattern behavior of life arc in her life.
Yeah.
The way she's behaving now and what she's doing now, I do not believe is incongruent for who she's been her entire life and the way she's interacted with others and the way she's controlled narratives her entire life, mm-hmm. especially when she's feeling insecure and defensive about actions she is taking. And so I think it's very congruent. The interesting thing also is what I think, again, conjecture is that what's happening is as she's seeing other people, whether it's her own defense or other people in her echo chamber, pointing out things that of possibilities, it's like floating ideas that we can see if we can grab onto and see if this works. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's not working. We'll let go of that one. And we'll see, grab onto this one. We're kind of seeing it in the Koberger case too with their defense. Oh, let's try to grab this one and see if this works. Ah, it didn't work. Let's try over here. Let's try this one. So I think you're getting multiple kind of personality things and attempts coming out here.
And that's going to be really interesting to see how it plays out in court, because in Karen land, I mean, she can insulate herself to a certain extent and believe she's the greatest and believe that everybody's behind her and that her story is what it is, that she couldn't have possibly hit John. And that's what she's saying now, contrary to everything that she had said in initial interviews. The problem with all of that is that all of that's going to be in the trial this time. That was not there before.
And when you say she couldn't possibly hit John. So you know me, I love probabilities.
Mm-hmm.
I don't say what happens or didn't happen, but let's just look at rational thought on things. This is what I kind of did a little bit of a deeper dive on when looking at this. So she says she couldn't reasonably hit John. She clearly admitted that she had been drinking and over drinking and overindulgence. So let's look at the law of probabilities. How many people and what percentage of people have accidentally hit someone or hit something and don't have a clear, accurate memory of that?
Mm-hmm.
That's a pretty high percentage.
Yeah.
Now, if we're now looking at the defense of what they're claiming as a possibility, because now they're trying to, and rightfully so, you know, there's been some very clear missteps, malfeasance, or bad investigative processes on the police department side, because we got lots of issues there, which completely undermined their own case. But let's just look at the house and the things they've claimed. Some of the things they're claiming is that Chloe the dog bit John O'Keefe. Mm-hmm. That's where the scratches and marks came from. So they're saying that this animal, from their defense, did this.
Mm-hmm.
So let's do a deep dive. This is as I understand it from the research I did, this is a dog that had been a police dog,
mm-hmm.
well-trained, with zero record of having bitten or being aggressive towards any individual that's on record. Mm-hmm. We can only go with records. So it's never been reported. It's never been documented. And a well-trained police dog just does not randomly bite arms, scratch, and do all the things they're claiming. So again, when you're just looking at a lot of probabilities, what's the likelihood that this dog's behavior from the documentation we have went from zero to 100?
Mm-hmm.
So that's a challenge there that I'm having. when you're looking at law of probabilities. And then you have the other probability that there was violence between whose home was it again?
Albert's home,
and O'Keefe.
Yeah.
Once again, you look at the documentation, look at reports of Albert's behavior towards O'Keefe and all the people involved. Has there ever been reports of that happening? Has there ever been escalations of violence or indications of aggression between those two or Albert and anyone?
Mm-hmm.
There's not. So what's the likelihood and law of probability of that going from 0 to 100?
Mm-hmm.
Then we just look at the law of probability of what's the probability of someone being over-intoxicated, inebriated, accidentally backing into someone and hitting them. Again, we're just looking at law of probabilities.
Yeah. And also, if you're looking at the law of probabilities, what's the probability? Let's go down the road for a moment of the story that he was beaten up in the house. Mm-hmm. Somehow the dog was involved in some way, shape, or form, which, again, still doesn't make a lot of sense or when or how this dog becomes involved. But let's say this something happened in there and then... What's the probability that a house full of cops who investigate this sort of stuff, who investigate crimes and bad behavior all the time, would find it to be a bright idea to drag him out to the front lawn and drop him right there? Not like in the path of the snowplow, not back behind the house where there's a railroad track, but literally just on the front lawn, right there. It's snowing. Eventually, yeah, he's going to get covered, but he's laying there initially where there isn't snow. So they thought if they killed him, this would be a great idea. Drag him to the front yard where he's still visible when cars are driving by.
And
what's that probability?
And then we can, and Tony, let's back it up even a little bit earlier into the evening and night.
Yeah.
So this isn't like O'Keefe just showed up at Albert's house uninvited.
Yeah.
This was an invite. This was an after party. This was let's keep it going. Mm-hmm. That's not something you do with people that have animosity towards you, that want to have a fight with you, want to escalate the behavior, and then stick their dog on you.
No.
But you see what I mean? I mean, all the data points of consistency with behavior are incongruent with what defense is claiming.
Yes.
And so there you go.
And until the defense has said, you can't claim this part anymore about the third party culprit. And they still are allowed to claim it. They just can't put Colin Albert in there, who was the kid, the 17-year-old who was, you know, doing good in school and everything. And then this completely upended his life, being accused of murder. Like, what are the odds there? Someone who has no history of violence, someone has no history of animosity towards police. I mean, his parents are officers. He grew up around police. That he's going to suddenly randomly attack and possibly kill one of his parents' friends and then continue to help them drag the body into the yard and then continue to cover up this story no matter what. Yeah, probabilities are our friend in this, because you just look at some of these scenarios and you go, that's extremely low. This is extremely low, because all of these pieces have to come together for this all to work out. And when they're all extremely unlikely, but they all would have to congruently come together. Yeah, that really tells you that doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
And the only thing you can do, so here you are on defense, the only thing you can do when your laws of probability are against you, as they are in this case, and in many cases, is that the only way to counteract that arc of all these behaviors of everyone is clear, articulate evidence, data points, and facts. And and that's what they keep trying to do with these interesting experts they have coming in to make really outlandish claims that are also incongruent with behaviors of animals, people, and things like that. So that's, I mean, it's a show. And now, granted, if they had just gone down the road of mea culpa, drunken stupidness, manslaughter, I don't think we'd be where we are.
I agree. Overcharged. I think the debate could be made of you know, did she hit him? You know, it's going to be interesting.
Who does anything intentionally when they're drunk?
Yeah, exactly.
That's what I mean. The intentionality to me and premeditation, all that, no way.
I think all that's so up in the air of did she hit him? We're going to find out more info because there is new vehicle data that's going to be used in this trial. Good. And that's not going to lie. That's also going to tell us when Karen Reed made those voicemails or sent those voicemails and started making the 50 some phone calls after she left, supposedly. It'll be interesting to see, well, what time were those made? Was she still sitting in that car waiting for him? Was she nearby? That's going to be a real interesting piece of all of this as a new piece of data. The dog bite information is going to come on, but they can't use the word Chloe. They just have to identify it as a dog. And they're also, they are going to bring in, from what I understand, some of the bite mark pieces of this, the dog's molding of and everything, to see, does this match up with John O'Keefe's bite wounds? Something they did not do last time, which I was really puzzled by, but maybe because it could go very badly for either side and neither wanted to roll the dice on it.
And that's what it would take. So like we were saying, in order to counteract the laws of probability, you're going to need very, very factual data points like that in order to do it. You know, and it's kind of like, you know, the Koberger case.
Mm-hmm.
Had it not been for one single touch point DNA data point, there's a lot of things in there that wouldn't fall in line because of laws of probability. But in this case, you know, it's everything is against her when it comes to the things they're claiming, unless they can actually prove it with data points, because it just does not line up with the behaviors of anyone involved.
A big thing in this is, like I said, it's going to be the tone of Karen Reed, the personality of Karen Reed, something we didn't really know a ton about last time. But now her voice is going to be used. It's not just going to be the frantic voicemails or the frantic craziness the morning that they're at the scene where John's body is found on Fairview. We're going to hear all the stuff from the interviews. And the contradictory behavior. It's not a question of character. This is not a trial of character. Being a seemingly someone who has a lot of narcissistic tendencies and ways of viewing the world and handling things doesn't make you a murderer. But she's on trial for murder. And you start really painting somebody in a super bad light. Sometimes people go a little bit further, even if there isn't 100% chance of looking at something without a reasonable doubt. And I'm wondering how much that could sink her. Just everything that she said and done after the fact, if she would have just been quiet and dealt with this on a more private level, rather than being the darling of the media, how this is going to help or hurt her in this round? How do you think it's going to play out?
I don't think it's going to help her at all. I think it's going to hurt her. And here's why. So we have another compelling case to compare and contrast this to that you and I cover really closely, mm-hmm. and that's the Delphi case.
Yeah.
And so just let's look at this. So here, both people accused of murder.
Mm-hmm.
And Delphi and Richard Allen is garnering a huge amount of support and compassion on his side, because where's his focus? And because all the media interviews, well, he doesn't do media interviews, but all the transcripts we have of every interaction with anyone, where is the focus? Is it on him as a victim or on the impact all this is having on people he cares about and he loves?
Mm-hmm. It's always about the people he cares about. It's always about
Karen
his
Reed's
wife.
Case, yeah. Where is all the focus every time she speaks?
Mm-hmm.
It's on her.
Yeah.
There's not a mention for the impact on O'Keefe's parents, on his kids that he's taking care of. I mean, we haven't heard, I don't know what she feels. I mean, it's just the focus is her. That does not resonate or inspire compassion on her side, regardless of anything else, you know? So that's why if she could do, in my opinion, she could do just as much broadcasting of exposure as she wants. But if she had just shifted, or even at this point, shifts that focus, as this aha moment was like, you know what? Wow. I've done some reflection and I realized I've seen myself and I'm embarrassed. You know, I got defensive. There's a lot going on. You know, this is my life on the line. But when I really take a moment to sit down and think about it, the actions that I took, either intentionally or unintentionally, really impacted negatively and profoundly tragedy in a lot of lives. And for that, that's where we need to focus.
Yeah.
I mean, can you imagine if she took that tenor and shifted that?
If she did it from the beginning, wouldn't it be amazing? I mean, she probably, if right off the bat it was, you know, I don't know what happened. I honestly, I don't remember, you know, I guess I was there, but I don't remember if
she stuck to her story, stopped listening to everyone else's.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it would have happened. That's what it would have been. And seriously, just think about it. No matter who she is, if she stuck to her muddled memory from the alcohol involved night that they all had together and just stuck to, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't think I did. It's not the kind of person I am. I'm so sorry. And remember, everyone else involved expected her to say the same thing.
Yeah.
And then when she didn't, that's when everything kind of shifted and went against her. That's when they're like, we got, you know, not all of them, but, you know, people are saying like, what the hell?
Well, yeah.
Who does it that way?
Well, she gave so many examples right off the bat. If you were just reading the tea leaves and going, well, this is rather bizarre behavior that otherwise was hidden behind the curtain of Karen Reed that only really John O'Keefe was seeing. In that relationship, those voicemails, you know, I'm sure that wasn't the first time she left a massive amount of voicemails on John O'Keefe's phone.
Guaranteed.
Yeah. And saying, controlling things, trying to guilt him. Your kids are home alone, John. They're home alone, like questioning his parenting skills, trying to guilt him, trying to make him be the bad guy when he's laying there.
Gaming him into behaviors.
Yeah. I can't imagine what this relationship had been like. Actually, I can. I've been in them. But yeah. That's the thing. I can see. I know this type of personality, this Karen Reed type. And no matter what, the narrative is always going to be they are right, you are wrong. They are the bright, shining one because they're obsessed with image. Like, that is everything above everything else is how am I perceived by the public? And she found a group of people who got behind her, and then she enlisted them basically as her flying monkeys. And these people have done her bidding. But what's been interesting in the last handful of weeks is as people have seen this documentary, seen her personality come out in a way that others have not in the past, see the contradictions in black and white. Some of those flying monkeys have decided to go back to Oz and say, I don't want to be part of the Wicked Witch's land anymore.
Yeah, and it is a complicated case in a sense that I still don't like the charges. I think, you know, I don't like them at all. I don't think they're accurate to what actually happened. And at the same time, you know, her behavior is incongruent with what she should have been doing, what she should have been feeling, you know, because, I mean, she doesn't inspire people to have compassion towards her when she keeps putting herself out there in the manner she's putting herself out there. And on the other side, yes, the handling of the case by the police department was way off, not good. There's corruption that's been uncovered in that police department. Although they just did do, I saw the internal investigation, you know, found them that, you know, they handled the case in, what was it? They made mistakes, but there's no corruption they found it involved.
Yeah.
So good. You know, I liked it. So again, you know, there's so many oopses along the way here. But again, let's go back to the most important thing. Parents and children lost someone. They lost O'Keefe, and justice must be served and must be done. But again, everyone made this thing way too more complicated than it needed to be.
Well, I mean, I get the other side to a certain extent too. I mean, there's a lot of questions there and things that look somewhat shady. I mean, everybody dumping their phones like right after this, them moving out of the house like a handful of months later and taking a loss on it after they just did some remodeling. I mean, you can remodel a house and then sell it. I've done that many times. The dog, getting rid of the dog. There's a lot of weird things where it's like, why? I mean, is this all just convenient timing? I mean, throwing away your phone in a dumpster on a army base? I mean, why? I mean, you know, you can trade those in, you know, you can get money for that or wipe it and sell it. Like, why are you throwing this away?
So here's what I think people were really not doing very well on this one.
Yeah.
I think everyone's loving critics were too close in. They weren't objective enough for them.
Yeah.
Because something I do with absolutely everyone I interact with, anyone I work with, train with, or consult with is, and even my own kids, you and I for each other, is let's play that tape forward a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Let's do the thought experiment where we take the action you're going to do, and now let's play that forward four steps and what it's going to look like if this happens, what it's going to look like if this happens, what's going to be your action. And, you know, so we take the event that, and again, not judging, we should or shouldn't do this. Let's imagine we do this, and now let's play this forward.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like everyone said, all right, let's do this. enroll.
Consequences be damned. we'll deal with it then. We'll ask for forgiveness later.
It was, you know, if there wasn't any malfeasance, because again, it doesn't matter what was true or not true in some cases. When you have a lot of inaccuracy of memories, it's going to come down to impressions that people have and perceptions. And when you give the perception of all this malfeasance because all these stupid actions you took because you didn't think it out clearly, or maybe you were intentional with it. See what I mean? I mean, it just there's so much uncertainty and all that's going to be present. And whether the jury hears it or not in testimony, it's always in the back of their mind because everyone's been seeing this case. I mean, there's no one who's not tainted on a jury ever on these days because the amount of social media, the amount of coverage. So there's going to be an impression that people give off. There's going to be an aura. I mean, just so all the people involved in this case give a nonverbal aura off in that courtroom.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't matter what they speak or not speak. I mean, it's very, very easy to assess because what you're doing is when you're assessing, you're looking for what you're expecting to see and then what you're actually seeing. And now when a jury is expecting someone, doesn't matter if it's this case or another case, a jury's expecting to see one who's being charged with murder who is innocent, you're expecting to see them look soft, contrite, apologetic, humble, you know, like this, sad, downtrodden. You're expecting to see this to some degree. Is this what you're expecting to see from Karen Reed? Or are you going to see, like we've seen in the courtroom, a smiling, a chat with people around you? I mean, so when you get this incongruences from expectation, it instills distrust. Because trust comes from open, honest communication, transparency, and vulnerability. Those are the behaviors of trust. And when you're in the courtroom and the jury's assessing people in the courtroom, they're assessing, is what they're saying trustworthy? Do they have the behaviors of trust? And all that comes across without even saying a word. It's all the nonverbals as well. So it's not helping.
And that's the problem with this case, because both sides feel untrustworthy. Like neither side feels like you want to totally get behind it. I mean, some people do because they want to be part of something. But if you're objectively looking at this case from both sides look shady as hell. And that's all where, that's why you got a hung jury. Because it's like either you're going to be someone who's going to jump on the bandwagon of either side because you want to do that and that's how your personality is. But if you're just like, well, this doesn't look the greatest over here. That doesn't look the greatest over here. The truth is somewhere in the middle, but no one's going to ever admit to anything. So how are we going to get there? And that's the problem with this case. I don't know that you truly can.
Yeah, I don't either. I don't know. I'm really hoping to see more than we saw last time in way of evidence to give us something to cling to so that when whatever the jury comes up with, you can say, that was righteous. And we'll see.
We will definitely see.
Want to stay on top of the latest true crime cases? Press subscribe now and never miss a breaking update from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
This podcast is sponsored by IQBar. Your favorite clean, functional, delicious nutrition brand is raising the bar with a little help from Thomas Keller, Michelin star chef of the French Laundry. IQ Bar and Thomas Keller have teamed up to create a salted caramel chip protein bar and yuzu mango hydration mix. With toasted macadamia nuts, rich caramel flavor, and brain-boosting nutrients, this bar is like having a Michelin star meal in your pocket. Pair it with the taste bud tingling yuzu mango IQ Mix hydration mix, packed with magnesium and adaptogens to improve clarity and mood. With Keller's culinary excellence and IQ Bar's commitment to great taste and clean ingredients, this limited edition collaboration is simply mwah. And the best part is that 10% of sales go directly to Chef Keller's nonprofit, Mentor, that supports aspiring young chefs. Great taste, great nutrition, great mission. Go to IQBar.com today and enter promo code KELLER20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products plus free shipping. That's IQBAR.com, promo code KELLER20. This podcast is sponsored by IQ Bar. Your favorite clean, functional, delicious nutrition brand is raising the bar with a little help from Thomas Keller, Michelin star chef of the French Laundry. IQ Bar and Thomas Keller have teamed up to create a salted caramel chip protein bar and yuzu mango hydration mix. With toasted macadamia nuts, rich caramel flavor, and brain-boosting nutrients, this bar is like having a Michelin star meal in your pocket. Pair it with the taste bud tingling yuzu mango IQ Mix hydration mix, packed with magnesium and adaptogens to improve clarity and mood. With Keller's culinary excellence and IQ Bar's commitment to great taste and clean ingredients, this limited edition collaboration is simply mwah. And the best part is that 10% of sales go directly to Chef Keller's nonprofit, Mentor, that supports aspiring young chefs. Great taste, great nutrition, great mission. Go to iqbar.com today and enter promo code KELLER20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products plus free shipping. That's iqbar.com, promo code KELLER20.